From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, UN report on the Syrian conflict, warning of civil war in Libya, latest on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, plus Boko Haram attacks Nigerian soldiers in Cameroon. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United Nations warns that mass atrocities by government forces and rebels in the three-year-old Syrian conflict and the influx of foreign fighters into the country threaten global peace and security. A new report by the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria accuses all parties in the conflict of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein reporting from the UN in Geneva.
The report speaks of the bleak existence of millions of civilians caught up in the fighting. It says all semblance of normal life in Syria is gone in a society where hundreds of civilians are dying each day as the fighting goes on with no regard to law or to conscience. The four-member Commission of Inquiry accuses the government of Bashar al-Assad of continuing to commit violations, including war crimes and crimes against humanity. In the first half of this year, it says the government fired missiles indiscriminately, killing hundreds of women and children. The report says government forces used chlorine gas on 8 separate incidents in western Syria. It says this chemical weapon was dropped in barrel bombs by helicopters in civilian areas. The commission also says the group calling itself the Islamic State is a threat to security in the region and the world. Commission Chairman Paulo Pinheiro says the group, also called ISIS, is an expansionary force that inflicts terror on innocent lives.
Among the most disturbing findings in this report are accounts of large training camps where children, mostly boys from the age of 14, are recruited and trained to fight in the ranks of ISIS along with adults. Members of ISIS have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in Aleppo and al-Raqqa governorates, including acts of torture, murder, enforced disappearance, and forcible displacement.
Pinheiro notes Islamic State does not have a monopoly on brutality in Syria's civil conflict. He says the atrocities committed by the group are shared by the government and other armed groups. The report is based on 480 interviews and a wealth of documentary material that chronicles what the commission calls the unimaginable brutality and human cost of the Syrian conflict. The commissioners say the Syrians feel abandoned by the world. They say the international community and the United Nations are paralyzed by the unwillingness of states to act to end the conflict. They blame this paralysis for the acute harm suffered by victims of this war. Commission member Carla Del Ponte tells VOA, there is total impunity in Syria. She says nobody is held responsible for the horrific crimes being committed every day by all the warring parties.
The Security Council should take the decision to defer to the ICC, International Criminal Court, the Syria case, the crimes committed in Syria, so that the permanent court can start proper investigation and issue the first indictment for the high responsible military and political responsible for that crimes. That it is a first important step to peace. But until now, as you know, the Security Council is doing nothing.
The commissioners are urging states to stop supplying weapons to the warring parties in Syria. They say these weapons are being used in the perpetration of war crimes and violations of human rights. They are calling for an arms embargo. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
White House spokesperson Josh Earnest said Wednesday the United States is doing all it can to bring about the rescue of Stephen Sadloff. He's an American journalist held captive by Islamic State militants in Syria.
The circumstances of Mr. Sadloff's hostage-taking are tragic, and our thoughts and prayers are with his family. And the United States is committed to his to doing everything that we can to try to recover him and rescue him safely and as soon as possible. We certainly would call on those who are holding him to release him. But it is the policy of the United States, and has been for quite some time, that this government does not pay ransom for American hostages. And not only do we not, well, and we don't ask others to pay ransom to secure the release of American hostages for the reasons that I laid out, that it only serves to allow those terrorist organizations to finance their operations and only puts at greater risk of the lives of other American civilians.
White House comments came as Sotloff's mother, Shirley Sotloff, released a video on Wednesday appealing directly to the Islamic State leader for her son's release. Ernest said he had no information to share about whether or not the journalist's mother received guidance from the Obama administration about the wisdom of releasing such a video.
I know that the members of this administration have been in touch with the Sotloff family on a regular basis, but I don't have anything to share in terms of guidance that was offered to them about the wisdom of doing a video like this.
Do you think it was wise for her to do this, or could this put her son in more danger?
I wouldn't venture an analysis on that question. She obviously, as is evident from the video, feels desperate about the safety and well-being of her son, and understandably so. And that is why our thoughts and prayers are with Mr. Sotloff's family at this very difficult and trying time.
31-year-old Sotloff went missing in Syria last year while covering the conflict there. Islamic State released a video last week in which he could be seen kneeling following the film decapitation of fellow journalist James Foley. Islamic State, which has declared a caliphate in the territory it's captured in Syria and Iraq, threatened to kill Sotloff if its demands, which include halting American airstrikes against the group, are not met. Another American writer, Peter Theo Curtis, was released on Sunday after 2 years of being held captive by another militant group operating in Syria, the Nusra Front. On Wednesday, Curtis said he was emotionally overwhelmed by his welcome home. Terms of Curtis's release, brokered in part by Qatar, has not been disclosed. Hamas fighters said Wednesday Gaza had won a day after a ceasefire deal with Israel ended a 7-week conflict. The spokesman of the Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, addressed reporters from a destroyed neighborhood. Abu Qaeda said Gaza has won as well as the people and the resistance. Gaza has won as it defeated the enemy at the border and forced them to withdraw during the night out of Gaza. An open-ended ceasefire mediated by Egypt held on Wednesday as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was facing strong criticism in Israel over a costly conflict with the Palestinian militants in which no clear victor had emerged. Palestinian health officials say 2,139 people, most of them civilians, including more than 490 children, have been killed in Gaza since July the 8th when Israel launched an offensive with the declared aim of ending rocket attacks from Gaza. Israel's death toll stood at 64 soldiers and 6 civilians. Israel is demanding that Hamas be disarmed while the Palestinians want an end to the extensive Israeli blockade of Gaza and the opening of a seaport and an airport. Libya's UN ambassador warned Wednesday that his country could collapse into what he called a full-blown civil war, and he urged armed groups to halt hostilities and to disarm. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that his remarks came as the Security Council adopted a resolution tightening an arms embargo and expanding sanctions to include militia leaders in Libya.
Libyan Ambassador Ibrahim Debashi told the UN Security Council that recent clashes among armed groups in the capital, Tripoli, and in eastern cities, including Benghazi, could send the country into a deeper conflict. He's heard here through an interpreter.
You are not unaware of the fact that the situation in Libya is complicated. And yet, this situation since the 13th of July has become even more complicated. And this situation might unravel into a full-blown civil war if we're not very careful and wise in our actions. And that needs to be true of all parties.
He said in the past, security incidents were limited, isolated, and rare. But the most recent clashes in and around the capital involved two armed groups using heavy weapons and targeting state institutions. In recent months, power struggles among several armed Islamist groups have intensified. Competing assemblies have elected rival prime ministers, and an interim central government is struggling to establish security. Further complicating the situation, U.S. officials said this week that Egypt and the United Arab Emirates launched airstrikes against Islamic militants in Tripoli. Ambassador Dabashi did not mention the airstrikes, but reporters asked the UN's top envoy in Libya about them. Tariq Mitri said he had no means of confirming the reports, but noted that there had been no clear denial.
I don't think airstrikes, if confirmed, that were perpetrated by outside forces, I don't think that can help. I don't think it has helped the Libyans cease fire and reach some sort of political agreement.
Mitri, who is leaving the UN mission in Libya after a two-year tenure, told the council in his final briefing that the armed clashes and deep divisions among Libya's political factions are very alarming. He said the fighting has displaced more than 100,000 Libyans and another 150,000 have left the country. The UN mission also has temporarily moved its international staff to neighboring Tunisia until the security situation calms down. He warned that the threat from the spread of terrorist groups has become real. Mitri said the political instability may have created fertile ground for a mounting danger in Libya and beyond.
We need to remind Libyan political leaders and brigade commanders that dialogue remains the only alternative to a protracted armed confrontation. No military solution is possible, and the present impasse will be deepened further by the use of force.
During the meeting, the Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution calling on all parties to agree to an immediate ceasefire and engage in an inclusive Libyan-led political dialogue. The Council also strengthened an existing arms embargo and expanded sanctions to target individuals and entities destabilizing the country and obstructing its political transition. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. The head of the African Development Bank has warned the Ebola outbreak is causing enormous damage to West African economies as foreign businesses quit the region and international transport suspend services. ADB President Donald Kaburuka said in Freetown Wednesday some economies may lose 4% of gross domestic product.
Revenues are down. Foreign exchange levels are down. Markets are not functioning. Airlines are not coming in. Projects have been cancelled. Business people have left. That is very, very damaging. Now, add to that the fact that this rainy season and people are not farming. So prices are going up, price of produce, at a time when purchasing power is limited, you are increasing poverty.
Liberia has already indicated it will lower its 2014 growth forecast. A Sierra Leone official said his government will miss its target of exporting $200 million in diamonds this year, with miners afraid to report to work in the Ebola-impacted East. The ADB has pledged $60 million to train medical personnel and purchase supplies to combat Ebola. Air France announced on Wednesday that it is suspending flights to Sierra Leone but maintaining flights to Guinea and Nigeria. On Tuesday, British Airways said it was suspending flights until 2015 to both Sierra Leone, and Liberia. But Brussels Airlines is resuming flights to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Meantime, a third doctor in Sierra Leone has died of Ebola. Dr. Sar Rogers worked at a hospital in the eastern town of Kanema. The United Nations Wednesday said it's providing $1.5 million to help the Democratic Republic of Congo fight Ebola, just days after the country confirmed 13 people died of the deadly virus. Nearly 1,430 people are known to have died in West Africa, while more than 1,600 cases have been confirmed. Later today, U.S. health officials will announce that a human study of the Ebola vaccine by GlaxoSmithKline will begin in a couple of weeks. And Reuters reports that the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Defense Department have approved the first step toward using three advanced laboratories to manufacture Ebola vaccines and treatment. and the U.S. Agency for International Development is providing an additional $5 million to fight the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Meanwhile, the emergency coordinator of the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, said Wednesday the number of cases in Liberia is rising rapidly and overstretching its staff.
The numbers is going up rapidly, faster than what we thought, forcing us to adapt our plans and our strategy on a daily basis. It is really an extremely challenging situation for everyone. And MSF, we can't do more than we're doing now. We've opened this center a week ago. It's completely full today. We are desperately trying to get more beds. We have bulldozers and rub holes getting up. We're recruiting staff, we're training staff. But we would like to do much, much more. But our first priority needs to be the security and safety of our staff.
Lindy Hurum said the Liberian healthcare system has more or less broken down, with many facilities closed and staff afraid to go back to work. She says the region faces a humanitarian crisis that is worsening every day. Also in Liberia on Wednesday, Dr. Tom Frieden of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control warned that the cases of Ebola are increasing, warning the crisis could get worse before it gets better. As the Nigerian government delays school openings nationwide in an effort to prevent the spread of Ebola, some education officials are baffled. With only one case of Ebola in the country in a year where hundreds of children have been killed or kidnapped from their schoolhouses, they're asking why cancel the classes for Ebola. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
It's still the summer holiday for most children in Nigeria. Schools were set to start opening beginning next week, but Nigerian officials announced Tuesday that classes won't resume until October 13th at the earliest. For some education professionals, the caution is welcome. More than 1,400 people have died of Ebola in West Africa this year, and although only five of the victims were in Nigeria, many people are deeply afraid. Rose Calton, a senior member of the union that represents public school teachers in Kaduna State, says the school delay is part of the Nigerian government's well-praised rapid response to the Ebola crisis that began here in July.
It's very welcome, and we want to appreciate them for that. And we should not think this thing will affect the education of our children. It won't. It will help us, and it will help our children too.
But some parents are angry, saying it makes no sense to keep schools closed. Ramatu Tijani, a mother, says people will still pack into churches, mosques, and markets, and children will be just as exposed.
Places whereby your fellow citizens do their daily activities. But in this regard, when it comes to Ebola now, government announcing that children don't go to school, you want them to become dumb.
Other education professionals say keeping schools closed is unnecessary and illogical. Private school owner Murtala Muhammad says the government seems to be contradicting itself, assuring Nigerians the Ebola threat is all but past on the same day it announces that schools will not open.
If this is something to be taken serious, then tension of school commencement of a session should not be on the basis of Ebola anymore.
The bigger problem Nigerian schools face, he says, is neglect and insecurity. Nigerian schools are being dragged down by lack of resources, long teacher strikes, and declining attendance, he says. Boko Haram insurgents, who have killed hundreds of schoolchildren in their schoolhouses and kidnapped hundreds more, have driven some parents to keep their children at home. Conversely, he adds, declining education is fueling the insurgency.
All the crises happening today, from issue of kidnapping to insurgency and all of you, if when you look at it, it's traceable to lack of education. If somebody is not properly educated, it cannot be productive, and therefore he will become a nuisance to the society.
Nigerian officials hope Ebola will be out of Nigeria entirely sometime in September, if current efforts remain successful. However, with the disease still spreading rapidly in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, officials say Ebola still threatens Nigeria and the entire region. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Cameroon is saying its military has killed some 30 suspected Boko Haram militants who attacked areas where 480 Nigerian troops had crossed over during a battle with the insurgents. Nigeria said the troops crossed over while making a tactical maneuver. Moki Edwin Kinsica reports now from Yaounde.
Cameroon's state radio reports government troops beat back two attempts by suspected Boko Haram militants to enter the country's northern territory through a locality that shares a boundary with Nigeria's Borno state, stronghold of the militant group. During a confrontation Tuesday, the soldiers killed 11 insurgents, while 16 more were killed in an earlier attack on Monday. Cameroonian soldiers seized heavy weapons and destroyed one of the vehicles the militants were using. The attack took place in areas where Nigerian soldiers had crossed over during a battle with the insurgents. The Nigerian military said the soldiers handed their weapons to Cameroonian authorities in line with standard practice and as an indication that they were not on any offensive against Cameroon. After the attacks, Cameroon's state radio announced that the country's president, Paul Biya, had ordered that the Nigerian soldiers be escorted back to their country.
The head of state has instructed that the columns of Nigerian soldiers who entered Cameroonian territory should be camped in specific locations and supervised by the Cameroonian army. The Nigerian soldiers have been provided feeding, medical treatment, and fuel on the instructions of the head of state. At the same time, the process of accompanying the Nigerian soldiers back to the country is underway on the Cameroonian military escort.
Colonel Dide Bajek, a Cameroon military spokesman, told VOA that allegations made in Cameroonian media that the incident was a defection were unfounded, but added that they were particularly careful over the presence of the Nigerian soldiers, as Boko Haram militants could also disguise as a regular army and attack them.
Laissons aux militaires le soin de mener l'art de la guerre tel qu'ils l'ont appris et soutenons-les car le combat est une épreuve.
He says people should support but allow the Cameroon army to handle the situation and fight Boko Haram as professional soldiers. He adds that they cannot neglect details in a war front and are consequently examining all hypotheses their enemy, Boko Haram, may want to use. Cameroon shares much of Nigeria's porous northeastern border. Boko Haram militants have been blamed for a rise in kidnappings, fighting, and criminal acts across the border from Nigeria's Borno state. Many surrounding villages where Boko Haram gunmen carry out attacks regularly are becoming increasingly deserted. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaounde.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians.
And
sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
And at the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament in New York on Wednesday, 21-year-old American Sloane Stephens was upset in the second round by Joanna Larsson in three sets, 5-7, 6-4, and 6-2. Second-seeded Simona Halep routed Yana Sapelova 6-2, 6-1. And how about this? Maria Sharapova came through the way she always does, beating 95th-ranked Alexandra Del Guro. The sets went 4-6, 6-3, 6-2 in the second round on Wednesday. Sharapova won the U.S. Open, you might remember, back in 2006, but has missed twice in the past 6 years. And for the men, number 6, Tomas Berdych, number 7, Grigor Dimitrov, and number 14, Marin Cilic, were among those advancing. And speaking of advancing, it's time to advance on to the next program, which is the latest world news. But meantime, thank you for tuning in to the Voice of America for today's International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On August 28, 1963, more than 250,000 demonstrators gathered on the Washington Mall to demand voting rights and equal opportunity for black Americans and to appeal for an end to racial segregation. The highlight of the gathering was a speech by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
On this date in 1981, the National Centers for Disease Control, noting a high incidence of Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis in homosexual men, announced a medical task force had been formed to find out why. Soon, these symptoms would be recognized as the disorder we now know as AIDS. On August 28, 1996, the troubled 15-year marriage of Britain's Prince Charles and Princess Diana officially ended. On this date in 1850, German composer Richard Wagner's opera Lohengrin was performed for the first time. The opera was an immediate popular success. Perhaps you've heard this part of the opera before. Traditionally played at weddings, the bridal chorus is commonly known here as Here Comes the Bride. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Humanitarian workers dedicate their lives to helping others affected by conflicts and natural disasters. They work in some of the most dangerous places in the world, risking their lives to alleviate the suffering of people in desperate circumstances. Humanitarian workers are the international community's emergency lifeline to vulnerable and isolated communities, said U.S. Alternate Representative for Special Political Affairs to the United Nations, David Dunn, before the U.N. Security Council. 108 million people are now in need of humanitarian assistance, and more people are displaced by violence worldwide than ever before. Yet for all the invaluable work they perform, aid workers are increasingly targeted by non-state groups, at times even by government forces. Over the past decade, this trend has been escalating. According to UN Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson, their safety is compromised in the most despicable of ways, by threats, by attacks, and by the use of illegal methods of warfare that endanger lives or damage the infrastructure needed for the delivery of assistance. Last year, 155 humanitarian aid workers were killed, 171 injured, and 134 kidnapped, a 66% increase from the previous year. The overwhelming majority were national humanitarian workers working to save the lives of their own people. Attacks against aid workers, said Ambassador Dunn, not only rob the world of brave, committed individuals, they also deny vulnerable populations critical, life-saving humanitarian assistance during dire humanitarian situations. The nature of armed conflict has changed, and with it, the risk to humanitarian workers has increased. To begin with, warring parties are no longer clearly defined, and many respect no laws, adhere to no universally accepted code of ethics. Add to that today's proliferation of small arms and the outsourcing of security work to modern-day mercenaries, and the result is an immensely more dangerous environment. Too often, there is no clear chain of command, and no one is held responsible for crimes perpetrated against civilians. Impunity for violence against humanitarian workers must end, said Ambassador Dunn. There has been little or no accountability for humanitarian workers killed in the line of duty. The United States supports efforts to strengthen accountability and to bring to justice the perpetrators of crimes against humanitarian workers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.